Outlet Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Well, hello and welcome along to this week's edition of The Profile with me, Justin Brierley. And don't forget that The Profile is brought to you in partnership with Premier Christianity magazine. Indeed, my guest is going to be featured in the October edition of the magazine. And if you'd like a free sample copy of the mag, then do go to premierchristianity.com/free sample. Joining me on The Profile today is the Reverend Giles Fraser. He's a priest, a journalist, a broadcaster, rector of St Mary's Newington, and a well-known personality, really, in the UK. His recent book, Chosen, Lost and Found Between Christianity and Judaism, tells the story of the personal crisis that followed his resignation from St Paul's Cathedral and the healing journey of reconnecting with his Jewish roots. So, Giles, welcome along to The Profile. Great to have you with us today.
Thank you, Justin. Nice to be here, mate.
It's good to see you. Tell us what life is like as a parish priest in a culturally diverse area of South London. What does that look like for you from day to day and week to week?
I'm an odd job man, really, with a sort of side issue of spirituality. It's just today has been one of those days where, you know, you just deal with everything from the organ needing fixing to Thames Water coming to sorting out the parish website to dealing with people's personal crises to, you know, there's just 101 different things. Some of it is very, very mundane. Some of it is clearing up people's needles because we have a bit of drug issue around here, and then going and doing morning prayer. So what can I tell you? It's the most diverse job on the planet, I think.
What's the, if you like, feel of the church that you pastor? Is it sort of high Anglican? Do you offer sort of daily, you know, Eucharist, that kind of thing?
It is high church, smells and bells, but all of the servers wear Nikes, and it's an odd combination of informal. It's a sort of just about a black majority church. But it has that sort of high church vibe as well.
That's interesting. Is that the vibe that you've enjoyed yourself? I mean, has that been your tradition, the high church, throughout your own priestly career, as it were?
It is. I quite like liturgical formality. I think the centre of my spiritual life is the Eucharist. So things sort of grow out from the Eucharist here in this church, and they do for me as well. I mean, I've been in all sorts of churches, but I think a sort of high church environment is one that I sort of naturally find conducive. Yeah, helps my prayer life.
I mean, without casting aspersions on other traditions, is it something about the fact that you're part of something that goes back literally millennia? Do you just find it? Do you struggle when there's, you know, guitars and drums? And
I'm not terribly good, and you're right, I don't want to cast aspersions on other traditions, but I'm not terribly good when people get all chummy with the divine, really. I'm not very chummy with the divine. I have a much strong, I suppose I have a much stronger sense of God's sort of a sort of mystical God's otherness, that God is hard, and I find the sort of like holy imminent sense of God as being, you know, next to me doing the washing up, and that's not quite so present with me. I find God difficult to access, I suppose, and that struggle to access God is something that happens through music, through beauty, through the scriptures, obviously, and through our tradition. But it isn't sort of. That's the best way of putting it. It's not being chummy with the divine.
Interesting way of putting it. Tell us about life growing up then for you. You weren't particularly, I think, raised in a household where church going was a sort of major part of life. How did you end up being a priest, given your background on that front?
No, it wasn't particularly religious. My dad's originally Jewish. He was in the RAF, so we've moved around all over the place. So I've been a bit of a nomad, going to all sorts of places. And so I went to boarding school from when I was seven. So there was a sort of an anchor there. And they were Anglican schools, but I guess nominally so. Perhaps that's a little unfair, but, you know, it didn't capture my imagination anyway. And I always thought of myself as a pretty hardcore atheist, and went to university. And it was at university that things started to change for me. I did philosophy at university, and one of the side issues for me was doing philosophy of religion. I started to read all these people that they just completely captivated my imagination. And it was a very bookish, very unfashionably bookish journey, Justin. You know, it was, and even, I mean, this is crazy now, but even to the point where, I mean, I sort of converted with my head in a book. And it was in a library, and I looked up, and the moment I thought that, I mean, for a long time I was one of those people that other people said, you know, he has this strange hobby, religion is this strange, this sort of thing that he's really interested in, and I'd never go to church, it wasn't a part of what I did at all, but the adventure was in the books,
right?
And I suddenly, in with my head in a book in the library in King's College London, I suddenly decided that this was it, I had to give my life to it. And I got up and went and found the nearest priest, who was the chaplain. And the very first thought I had, was, I'm going to be a priest. I want to be a priest, which was crazy because I didn't even go to church, Justin. I mean, I didn't even go to church. And so I found this poor, unsuspecting chaplain, and I told him that I was going to be a priest and this was terribly important. How did I do it? And he obviously thought I was completely crackers, and very kindly explained the process to me. And anyway, that's what happens.
Wow. And the rest is history, as I say. How did your family react to this remarkable conversion at university?
Well, I thought it was some sort of eccentric. I think they thought it was another form of rebellion, another form of eccentricity. And in a sense, it was. I mean, it was another form of rebellion. It was, you know, it was a sense that the secular language that I had been given and that I sort of fully inhabited was not able to describe the fullness of what I wanted to describe about the world. You know, there was so much more I wanted to say, and the language, the secular language that I had was just not capable of describing what it is that I was sort of yearning for. That's not to say it was a sort of conversion where I felt absolute certainty. It was a sort of conviction that this is what I had to do with my life. And all my sort of, all my beliefs have all been playing catch up with that, really. You know, it was definitely faith seeking understanding. I remember going to theological college and for the first night and lying there and looking up at the ceiling and thinking, oh, my word, have I started to write checks that I can't intellectually cash? You know, I mean, I'm just, you know, these, you write these faith checks, but is there enough belief in the bank to cash it out? Well, I think that's actually quite a lot of people have that experience, you know. Totally. And I, in a sense, I've sort of had that experience throughout my ministry, but I've learned to sort of be much more relaxed about it.
Right.
Faith is the sort of conviction, and the intellectual doubt sort of are something that I don't, that doesn't trouble me as much as it used to.
In some ways, it may be the opposite. That's the danger in ministry, of being absolutely sure that you're the most qualified person for this, because that can breed a kind of arrogance, I suppose.
I'm definitely not the most qualified person for this, but I don't even know what it would be to be qualified for this, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I mean,
yeah,
if you look at the people that God calls throughout the scriptures, I mean, he does call a funny collection of wrong'uns and strange people, doesn't he? I mean, you know, there's just like throughout the scriptures, I mean, David, I mean, I ask you, you know.
That's really helpful as an introduction to sort of your own path towards priesthood. Tell us a little bit about your own family, though, because obviously in your book Chosen, Lost and Found Between Christianity and Judaism, it's really a journey where you call it a ghost story, because it's rediscovering the kind of religious ghosts that you hadn't quite realized were there in your past, especially on your father's side with the Judaism. Now, he had sort of left that behind to some extent, I think. And so it wasn't particularly something that was talked about, I believe, when you were growing up. Just tell us about the circumstances that led to you reconnecting with the Jewish background on your father's side of the family.
Yes, of course. So, you're right to say that it wasn't. So it was something I sort of knew about, that my dad had was born Jewish and then was baptized confirmed later in life, I didn't know much, really much about it. And I knew that my surname Fraser was originally Friedeberg. So there was obviously a backstory to that. Mm. But it was after I was 10 years ago, in a few months' time, there was the whole Occupy thing at St. Paul's. And I was the canon chancellor of St. Paul's Cathedral, and I resigned out of a difference of view with my colleagues about how that should be approached. And I had no idea what I was supposed to be doing next. I mean, I really didn't. There really wasn't a plan B even. But anyway, the Bishop of London suggested that I go and look at a job in Liverpool. And so I went up for the job interview, and I always get to places really early. And I got up there and I was feeling sort of like, I don't know anybody in Liverpool. I sort of feel quite lonely in Liverpool. It felt like I was almost exile. And as I was sitting there having a cup of coffee early in the morning, one thought crossed my mind, which was that actually there was a very distant connection, which that was my great grandfather's brother. So that's pretty distant, was the person who ran the synagogue in Toxteth in Princess Road, a beautiful synagogue. So I went up and had a look and knocked on the door, not really expecting very much, and a caretaker let me in. And then I saw this oil painting of my distant relative hanging on the wall, wearing a dog collar and looking to all extent purposes like an Anglican clergyman, but he ran the synagogue. And that's what, you know, Jewish religious leaders looked like in the...
There was a kind of assimilation almost, wasn't there?
Huge amount. And, yeah. And the books, a lot of the books about that story of assimilation, yeah. about how a lot of Jewish leaders, called the Minhag Anglia, they wanted to be, you know, like mini versions of the Jewish versions of the Church of England, you know. Sure. And the very existence of the chief rabbinate is an attempt to copy the idea of the Archbishop of Canterbury. Mm. Anyway, so I looked at this oil painting and I had a sort of something quite profound moved within me. I don't know how to describe it really. And I went and sat down at the side of the road and I just wept for a long time. And it was like suddenly I just didn't know my place. I mean, it had been quite difficult to leave St. Paul's and to work out where my place was in the world. And this was another, where are you from? What are you all about? And I sort of like, there was a sort of, a crisis that happened. Disraeli said to Queen Victoria that he felt like the blank page between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And I sort of felt a bit like that. Queen Victoria had no idea what he was talking about, but I really, really do. It was that sense of being caught in between, of that something having been lost without it being mourned. So the book is an attempt to sort of negotiate that space, really. And I mean, it doesn't resolve it as much as I sort of feel comfortable in that in-between type of space, or if that's the right way of even describing. And obviously the relationship that I had with my past is also there on a much wider canvas in the relationship between Christianity and Judaism. This is a complicated relationship. And it's one that most Christians don't fully sort of understand a lot of the complexity about it, that Jesus wasn't a Christian, that, you know, probably Paul wasn't, you know, probably that world wasn't even, I mean, used of St. Paul, you know.
Yes.
So these were Jews. Jesus' first followers were Jews. They died as Jews, most of them, not all of them. And you know, Jesus was a temple-going Jew. He had disagreements with the temple, but like many Jews did, that's not, you know, that. So how does this, you know, people have asked this question before, but for me, this is a sort of existential question about my being. How does this thing called Christianity develop out of Judaism? Is it a parent-child thing? Is it a divorce thing? Is it, what's the right metaphor for it? So that's what I was looking at.
It's very much is part personal memoir about, as you look into and come to grips with your own Jewish ancestry, and a theological kind of account of the way Christianity, as it were, came to account for the way its own relationship to Judaism. And to that extent, what you know, on the personal side of this, what did this journey do for you? Because, I mean, maybe just talk a little bit more about those circumstances that led you to that moment in Liverpool on the side of the road, bawling your eyes out.
Yeah.
You'd kind of been going through something of a personal crisis. For those who haven't, you know, are not up to speed, and we've got a lot of listeners, especially on podcast in the US, who won't be aware at all, probably, of the Occupy movement, what happened at St. Paul's 10 years ago. Just explain, you know, your role at St. Paul's, what happened in that in that instance. And then perhaps we can sort of see how that led on to this particular.
Well, let me say a general point before I answer that specific point. The general point about the relationship between autobiography and theology is a rather important one. And some people have read the book and said it's two books. One is a sort of personal reflection and one is theology. It's not. It's absolutely not. It's that I don't think there's any way of doing theology properly without it being properly personal. And that's what you know, before the advent of the university, where the university is the thing that did theology, you'd get books like Augustine's Confessions, which is, you know, about him nicking fruit and his views about, you know, his own sexual desire and all of that lumped in with prayers and theological reflections. So the genre has become, I think, narrowed. Theology genre has become narrowed down to something that's done by theologians, and I regret that. So it's it's an attempt to push back against that by being personal. But yes, so the circumstances of what happened at St. Paul's was, I was the sort of I was the canon theologian, I guess, at St. Paul's Cathedral, and the Occupy movement turned up. They turned up for the stock exchange, which was next door to the cathedral. They got kicked off the land and they camped outside St. Paul's Cathedral. And there was and historically, the thing about St. Paul's is historically its grounds were used as, going back to the Middle Ages, a place of debate. This was a place of public debate. And whatever we think of Occupy, there was, after the crash of 2008, there was a really strong sense that how the markets worked, whether they worked for the benefit of all. This was a live issue of public debate. So in a sense, I thought, well, this is opportunity as well as, you know, obviously a practical challenge to the cathedral. And it sucked in many different views about, you know, there were some people who thought, these are all smelly layabouts and, you know, what are they doing here? And there were those who thought that actually they were raising important matters of public concern. So, you know, so actually what happened was, right early on when they first turned up, I was sort of officer watch for the great ship St. Paul's. I had to deal the first morning on a Sunday morning with a situation where I sort of, there was a whole load of protesters outside the church and people couldn't get in for worship. So I had a hunch that if I asked the police to move aside, that the protesters might do the same. And that's what I asked, and that's what happened. And people were able to access the church. In a sense, it sort of worked well, but the press picked me up the next day as being a sort of like revolutionary. That I'd asked the police to stand aside, which I actually asked both. And then one of the protesters said, are we allowed, you know, can we come to church? Well, you know, that's a no-brainer for a priest to be asked if you can come to church. Everybody's welcome to church. So the headlines were, Canon says police move aside, protesters welcome to church, you know. And it was one of those sort of headlines which is, although technically true, it's rather, you know,
arguably, Giles, it was also, you know, perhaps feeding into a certain expectation. You were writing a regular column at this point for The Guardian, you know, very left leaning paper. You were reading into this situation. Hey, there's revolutionary left leaning Giles,
correct, you know,
for the Occupy protest.
I'd like to think that, I mean, my politics has turned quite a long way away from that since, but I'd like to think that even if it was someone with a completely different political hue, they'd have still could easily have made the same decision, you know. And And I would have hoped and expected, if protesters said, "Can we come to church?" that they too would have said, "Yes, of course, you're very welcome." That's not a particularly revolutionary view, but you are correct. I have had a sort of like left and even a hard left past, that it did indeed, you know, it was very easy to make all those links.
But in the end, you came to a crunch point where there was a decision needed to be made by the authorities at the cathedral about what to do with the protesters. And you at the time were very much about, no, we need to, it'll be absolutely the wrong thing to force, with violence especially, these protesters to leave. This came to a head. Do you want to just describe what that meant?
So everybody had their convictions about this, and it was like, this is a very fast moving and difficult situation. It was, and you know, but I watched a YouTube clip of the police evicting Occupy protesters, as it were, from Melbourne, it happened to be in Australia, and they went in there and they were whacking people around their heads with batons and pushing, and I thought, really, if that's what could happen here, and it's the church that's sent in the police, I think that's a really, I can't do that in conscience. I really can't. And okay, it's a mess, and it's, there's practical problems and so forth. But you know, there's ways of negotiating without the church sending in the police. But my colleagues had different convictions; they saw it differently, and so and they voted for eviction. By the narrowest of margins, but I felt that I couldn't really carry on down that path with a sort of integrity. So that's why I felt I had to go. It's a hard decision, because you know, some people will say, "Well, you stay in and you fight for what it is you believe," but there's always a point where you go, you know, if I don't resign at this point, all the things that I've said I believe don't really count for very much, you know. So, and it was clearly a turning point in my career, in my life, you know, and all sorts of things.
It was a brave decision to take, I think. But obviously it did leave you sort of cut adrift at that point, and a sudden change of, you know, prospects, suddenly, you know, in need of employment, if only to support yourself and the family. What was that period like? And I think you even arguably doubted your vocation. I mean, I think you'd looked at the possibility of, you know, jumping ship and doing something else.
Very, very briefly, it was that was I've always felt a very strong calling to be a priest and to be and actually to be a parish priest. So, you know, there was, you know, all of that sort of stuff, it plays with your head. I mean, you know, at the height of it, I would get, you know, phone calls from major political figures. Ed Miliband would call me up and say, "Well done this." And Boris, who was mayor of London, called for my resignation. And then someone would call me up and say, "Do you want to go into I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here?" And, you know, your brain is exploding with ridiculous sort of things that normally you don't have to deal with. So I was, you know, for a few weeks, I didn't know what I should be doing. But it pretty clearly, you know, it was pretty quickly it became clear that, of course, I'm a priest. This is what I do. So I just have to reimagine. And I think the resignation, in a way, was also good for me, because I think us clergy don't often realise the insidious way in which you can think of yourself as more important than you are, especially in a place like St. Paul's. And there's a sort of little vanity, there's all those sorts of things that creep in, and however much you pretend they're not there, you know that they were there when you lose them, you know, and you lose that sort of sense of self-importance. So spiritually, it's very good for me. It was exactly what needed to happen.
But at the same time, you do describe this period of kind of drifting a bit in terms of just, you know, losing a bit of focus. Obviously,
Dark Night of the Soul stuff, Justin. Yeah, and the book starts in a very dark place. You know, I mean, it starts contemplating with suicidal thoughts, and you know, my marriage fell apart, and I drank too much, and you know, all of those sorts of things that are characteristic of that sort of those sort of crisis times. And so the book is also about trying to write my way out of that sort of dark night of the soul, really.
Yeah, and that's obviously where, you know, the story picks up this new chapter, as it were, when you it was actually, I think, in the circumstances where you were looking at a possible job at Liverpool Cathedral when you decided, just on a whim almost, to go to that synagogue and then saw this picture of your ancestor and suddenly
and the poor publishers of this book. So when I resigned, they said, would you like to write a book about capitalism or in the city and so forth, and I said, you know, I'm happy to do that. What they got was a book on Christian Jewish relations. I mean, and it was like, how on earth did this happen? You know, you resign from St Paul's, it's all about economics, it's all about, you know, the 1% and all this sort of stuff. But actually, and I didn't tell people, you know, people knew I was having a hard time, but a lot of it got put into, how weird, isn't this? Yeah. I got it put into this relationship between Christian. That's what I was thinking about in the course of this crisis. But actually, it's not surprising, because really what I was thinking about is, who am I? Where am I in the world? How am I rooted? How am I placed? And that became focused on the relationship between me and my Jewish past and that, you know, the lostness of that. And so in the end, looking back, it looks like an obvious thing to write about. But.
And a good, you know, 6 years in the making and many revisions of it. I think this was a cathartic experience by having read the book. But we'll come back to it. We're just going to go to a break and we'll continue talking about how that's worked out, and especially in your current family, which there's an interesting Jewish aspect to now. Also love to talk about something you did already mention, that your own political views have changed quite significantly since probably 10 years ago when you were at St Paul's, and we'll talk a bit about that too. But you're listening to The Profile today. Reverend Giles Fraser, priest, journalist and broadcaster, joins me, Justin Briley, here on the show, and we'll be back very shortly.
These days, you can't get a lot for your pound. You could get a pack of balloons,
a DIY face mask,
or some plasters. Ouch. Or £1 could get you great reporting, brilliant interviews, and loads of Christian news articles, all in Premier Christianity. In print, online, and on the app. For just £1 a month in the summer sale limited offer. Get yours at premierchristianity.com. The Profile.
You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to this week's edition of The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. It's available on its own Profile podcast. You can check that out at premierchristianradio.com/The Profile. And every week we're joined by interesting people from all walks of life to talk about their Christian journey. Giles Fraser is rector of St Mary's Newington, well known as a UK journalist and broadcaster too. And his recent book, Chosen, Lost and Found Between Christianity and Judaism, tells the story of the personal crisis that followed his resignation from St Paul's Cathedral, and this healing journey of reconnecting with his Jewish roots. And we'll come back to the book in a moment. I mean, one thing that has been hard not to notice is the fact that your own political sort of views have changed quite a bit over the last several years. I mean, as I said, at one time perceived as pretty left wing, you know, column in The Guardian, on the side of the protesters and all the rest of it. But it feels like you've taken more of a swing to the right in recent years. So firstly, the first sort of I got wind of this was, oh, Giles is supporting Brexit. I was not expecting that from you when I was at the time setting up some debates, and I actually approached you as a Christian who might speak on the Brexit side. And then you even voted Conservative at the last election. You've become a regular columnist and a podcast host for Unheard, which is an online publication that's very much sort of in the sort of anti-woke, more right-leaning generally kind of viewpoint. So what's heralded this change in recent years, Giles?
Well, I hate talking about Brexit now. It's just like, oh, God, it's such a divisive issue. But the thing is, I was on that sort of Tony Bennish hard left. And we were always anti the European Union. This is always the tradition of the left. And in a sense, I haven't really changed many of my views on economics, as it were. I still have what would be called a sort of left-wing view about redistribution, about tax, about the role of the state and all of that sort of stuff. And so that side of it is the same. But I suppose Brexit did make a difference. I thought I was just continuing what the argument had always been on the left. But suddenly I found myself cancelled, I suppose, from a sort of left-wing position. And I was puzzled by this. And then, of course, when you're attacked from the side that you had traditionally been on, you begin to see things from a slightly different perspective.
Mm.
And I guess I've always, even though I've been a socialist, though I don't know if I'd use that word anymore, I've never really been a liberal.
Mm.
So this is a very different sort of, it's a very, and for American listeners, this is hard to sort of like fathom, because the word liberal means something different to us than it means in America.
Mm.
But for me, the sort of liberalism is liberalism of free market economics, where the individual comes first. It's all about the sort of like everything beginning with the sort of solitary individual and with choice. And I've always been a communitarian. I've always believed in the we precedes the I in church and in ethics and in all sorts of things. So, but I have felt that the left has become more and more liberal. Mm. Whereas the left that I began with was not liberal particularly. Now the left is really all about my rights, my self-assertion. And I have a much more communitarian view. So, and that, you know, that actually is also expressed on the more on the right as well.
Mm.
So I suppose that's part of what's happened. I've actually felt I don't think I've changed too much. I mean, a bit, but I think the categories around me have changed. I think we've lost a sense of what left and right used to mean, you know. And so,
and as a presumably lifelong, maybe Labour voter up to, you know, the point you twitched allegiance at the last general election, was it the fact that you were seeing the left-wing politics change around you that sort of forced you in the other direction? I mean,
well, at the 2019 election, there was no way I was going to vote for Jeremy Corbyn with anti-Semitism, with all the stuff about anti-Semitism that was coming out. That was just not possible for me. And then also the stuff about Brexit. I thought it was terribly important that we reclaimed our ability. For me, the most important thing about Brexit was that sovereignty was repatriated. For many people, I used to be a parish priest on a outer city council estate in the West Midlands for a little while. And one of the things that was obvious to me is that people felt power was incredibly distant. It was like, no one's going to listen to us. No one cares what we think. And I feel I made myself a promise that I'm sort of on your side. You know, I've got to be on your side about this. And Brexit was, we want power to not be in some distant place, but actually to be closer to home, that we can change our lives through the exercise of democratic power. And so that for me was, you know, that for me was the absolutely only reason that I voted for Brexit and Brexit, and was like very enthusiastic about it, and still am, actually. I mean, I think it was the most important thing that we've done in this country in my lifetime.
And more latterly, your concerns in this sort of department have been around the kind of rise of progressive woke politics and ideologies and so on. And to that extent, I mean, you've even penned an article for Unheard recently called "Why Is the Church So Woke?" Do you think that this is a problem within your own, you know, your own area of work, the church?
What do I think about this? Look, identity politics is, I don't like the idea that identity politics becomes a sort of substitution for the sort of politics which is concerned with the poor and with people who. So the idea that you focus on issues of other sort of issues, but ignore people who are living in poverty, that one really, really bothers me. There's a fantastic book about, I think it's Harvard or Yale. And this guy analyzes the sort of, you know, all the classes and their demographic. And they have all sorts of demographics. They have, you know, different sorts of people, gay and straight, black and white, all this sort of thing, but no poor people. You know, this is like, they're all middle. And this to me felt like one of the things that was going on here. It's not that I'm against these issues, and I'm on the, in a sense, I'm on the woke side of all these issues, probably. But wokeism as a whole package, I don't like the word, so I'm sort of putting it in inverted commas, Justin. My problem with it is it misses out the sort of thing that I was concerned about as an old style socialist, which is the condition of people living in poverty. And that includes the white working class, who are often traduced in this whole amalgam of politics. So, you know, I'm pro-gay, all of this sort of stuff. But I just don't want all of that to carry the weight of what it is to be, as it were, progressive.
I don't know if you know, when I've spoken to other people about this issue, people who you know have similar concerns and may not be coming from exactly the place you are, but I'm thinking of you know, people like Douglas Murray and others who've, you know, written extensively on these issues. They perceive that there's almost a religious aspect to this, and almost that these types of ideologies have become in themselves a kind of causes that have a religious nature and that become ultimate to people, and that there's a danger to that, because it's a kind of fracturing of society when you know every issue becomes ultimate to each individual. Would you agree with that?
I think there's something to that. I mean, I'm not on the same page as Douglas Murray about a lot of issues, really. And as I say, my instincts are actually very, very different to Douglas's. But I do look. I'm a parish priest. I have a sense of the community in all its fullness gathering around the altar. And I want it to be the most genuine, inclusive and diverse. God calls all people to come here. So the idea that you that somehow you express your identity so exclusively in terms that, you know, where other people are the enemy, I'm afraid I think that's what bothers me most about this particular moment, is that we find it very difficult not to see people who disagree with us as the enemy, and that they're the political enemy. And it's become, perhaps I've been guilty of that. Well, I'm sure I've been guilty of that in the past myself, but I have a much stronger sense of how divisive and unpleasant these sorts of,
I mean, these times some, have become. Some specific, you know, there have been some real kind of very well-known examples. I mean, J.K. Rowling obviously has been at
cancelling is terrible stuff.
Right.
Cancelling is, I mean, for Christians, that there should be no cancellation. You know, we're people of forgiveness, and forgiveness is about keeping people in the fold. I just don't. I mean, I think that's the woke thing at its worst. That's the stuff that I really react badly to. Mm. You know, never kissed a Tory when people were wearing. Why not? Mm. I mean. Mm. Give it a go. I mean, it's just like, what is it about people that makes them sort of like some sort of political lepers that you can't? Yes. I find this extraordinary. I've always found that extraordinary business where people find that some people don't have anything to give them, don't have anything to say to them. And it's almost as if you're denying your common humanity with other people. And that really does bother me a lot.
Mm-hmm. You described yourself in that article as having found your inner conservative. I mean, you mentioned Roger Scruton as a significant kind of influence on that front. Do you want to just, for those who aren't familiar with him, and he obviously passed away a little while ago, sort of describe him? I think you've had the opportunity to interview him, haven't you?
Yeah. So he described himself as a paleo-conservative in American terms. He lived in America for a while. So it's that sort of conservatism, which is more about, I mean, I'm summarising, you know, but it's more about country. It's more about place. It's about rootedness. It's about beauty and architecture and things like that, rather than free market economics. So he was to the right of me on that particular subject. So this idea of some sort of rootedness, and that rootedness is terribly important in place where you come from. And I share that sense of that being important. I mean, I'm a parish priest. This parish has been here for 700 years. I feel a sense of rootedness in place. And I suppose also because of my history of feeling, apropos the book, feeling slightly deracinated about rootless, I think I think I appreciate that sense of rootedness of place, of history, much more than I used to. So, you know, if people want to say a sense of patriotism about loving your place, loving your country, loving your people, if that's sort of right wing, then well, so be it. But I don't see why it should be particularly, you know.
Let's stop talking about politics and talk about more important things, Giles. Family, because right. Your family yes. situation has changed in recent years yes. as well. And you bring it out very well in the book Chosen, because you're married to someone who is Jewish. And that's had an interesting impact on the way you bring up the children as well that you've had now. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think the most striking thing, I've got two wonderful little ones, but my wife is Jewish, she's Israeli. We talk Hebrew at home. Ani mevin aval ani lo medaber. I understand a little bit. Ani mevin kitzat. I understand a little bit, but I don't really speak it. So yeah. That's what I do. I know enough to know when my mother-in-law is talking about me. That's the sort of Hebrew that I have. Mm. But my boys are both pretty much bilingual. They speak as much English as they do Hebrew. So that's an unusual Anglican vicarage where Hebrew is the default language. A beautiful language. And, you know, the more you learn about Hebrew, obviously, and I find languages difficult because I'm dyslexic. So, but the more you learn about Hebrew, the more the Hebrew scriptures come alive, you know, in the most wonderful way. So I suppose that's the, you know, but I also at my, you know, advancing years, I have two little ones, which is obviously, as you say, the most important thing, the most important thing for me. And I love them with all my kids. They're wonderfully blended and get on with each other. And that's
and,
all
and
grand.
How, what do they think of themselves of if they think of themselves at all as anything? Christian, Jewish? Neither.
Well, I mean, they're too young, really, for all of that stuff at the moment. Mm. So, you know, 5 and 2, that's not a...
Sure.
But these categories, look, the rabbi came from North London and circumcised them according to the law, according to proper Jewish ceremony, because they're Jews. But I could not... I'm a priest, so baptism was also something that had to happen. And the book, not to give anything particularly away, but the book ends with me baptizing my youngest in the Jordan, in the place where, by reputation, Jesus himself was baptized by John the Baptist, and surrounded by my Israeli Jewish family. And it was like, for me, it's a sort of it was a healing moment. Mm. Now, the question is, am I passing on to them a sort of fault line, a gap, a pain? Mm. It was some sort of pain to me. Or is it something, well, I mean, to start with, the way I want them to be bilingual, both in language and in their religion. Mm. Now, actually, that's not too difficult in Christian terms. You know, I mean, you know, we are intellectually Jews as well as Christians, you know, if we're Christians. So that's sort of okay. Obviously, it's much more problematic from the Jewish side that they were baptized. And I just have to, you know, if they end up rejecting all of that when they get older, then I suppose they'll just have to say, well, I'm afraid I had a vicar as a dad and he did what he did. You know, I mean, I don't know how to formulate it, but at the moment, you know, this is what I have to give them, and I'll give them as what I think is right. And
yeah, well, at least they'll have a whole book to be able to understand your thought process.
They will, yes.
But I mean, when it comes to you just having those conversations when the time comes, obviously, with well, Dad, you know,
what am I?
We do this. What am I? We go to church. I mean, how will you explain the person of Jesus to them? Let's start there. What will you say?
I'm a pretty straightforward Orthodox,
yeah,
you know, Anglican priest. So Jesus is the Son of God, and you know, this is what I think. I don't. Yeah. I have a very straightforward Christian view about this. So that's what I think, and that's what I'll explain. Mm. But there will come a point where they'll have to have, you know, work that out for themselves. Well, actually, that's not a bad thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So I will give, it's not like they're being given no religion mm-hmm. and then they sort of have to start from scratch. In fact, they'll have quite a lot of resources with which to deal with those questions. They'll feel comfortable in church. They'll feel comfortable in synagogue. They'll have their Hebrew. They'll have their sort of Anglican choral tradition, I think, as well. They have all sorts of things which will go into helping them make that decision when they're older. So I'm not preparing them for a world that's not complex. The world is complex. So, you know, they're being prepared for that. Sorry, I expressed that badly. They're being prepared for a complex world, but they also are not being, there are options there for them, you know.
And in a sense,
I'm erring a lot, Justice. Yeah. I'm going a lot because it's obviously difficult. You know, yeah, I think a lot of people who are in mixed marriages will understand something of this. I actually think it's, I think Christians and Jews in marriages, I think it works much better in practice than it does in theory.
Okay. You know,
so we do Friday night dinner, we do prayers for that. It's all fine. It's absolutely fine for daddy to do, you know, you know, and so there's quite a lot which is that works pretty straightforwardly, actually.
That's interesting to hear. And to what extent is it important or not important that the church sort of engages with this issue? Because many people will feel like, well, this is an interesting theological journey you've been on, Giles, and obviously it ties very directly into your own personal family situation, that these all these theological questions around Judaism and Christianity. Does it matter to the average churchgoer, to the average church, specific relationship with Judaism and that kind of thing?
Get out your Bible. Okay, first of all, work out how much of it is sometimes called the Old Testament. Work out what is that? What is that? 4/5? You know, and then something like that. So first of all, there's that argument. And then actually, even more radically, I want to say there's not that much new about the New Testament. OK, the New Testament is also fully impregnated with the sort of Jewish worldview that, you know, there's a bit of the Greek worldview coming in. There's a little bit of, but not all that much. You know, it's predominantly still a Jewish worldview that's being expressed here. And as I said, rather importantly, Jesus wasn't a Christian. So, you know, it just, I know that sounds like it's been deliberately shocking, but, you know, seems to me unquestionably true, you know.
Yes.
So, I mean, Christianity is one of the weirdest religions in the world insofar as the person at its center wasn't a member of the religion that he founded. You know, that's a very odd business. Yeah. So, you know, if that isn't an answer to the question of why Christians should care about Jews and Judaism, I don't know what is.
But then you have this interesting thing, which is that it's very often when you do find the Christians who are the most interested in Jews, they tend to be coming from often a very Zionist perspective and believing that, you know, a whole set of things, the establishment of the State of Israel and everything have to happen in order for Christ to return. And that will involve all kinds of political and, you know, issues and so on. And that's obviously very strong in the States. But I don't
be careful with the word Zionist. That I'm definitely a Zionist, but a Zionist can simply mean you believe in the existence of the State of Israel. So being a Zionist doesn't necessarily come with all that other baggage.
All right. Well, that's really helpful, because I suppose I want to get a sense, just as, you know, and we're in the final minutes really here, but of where, what that means for you in practice, because I don't get the sense that you are a kind of political activist on behalf of Israel and so on. But what does it mean? What does it look like for you if you're not kind of, if you like, coming from that kind of perspective?
Well, I tell you what it means to me is when you, this is why I would describe myself as a Zionist. I have two beautiful Jewish boys. And when you see anti-Semitism rising in this country, when you see it being, I think, endorsed at the highest political levels, then what is Israel? Israel is a life raft in a dangerous world for for people like my beautiful boys, is that, you know, anti-Semitism doesn't always go away. Sometimes it, you know, we sometimes think you have it beat, but it isn't beat. And that is their place of safety. That is their place of safety. And I will always believe, you know, what gave Zionism its sort of final impetus is the Holocaust. And that's, for me, why that's its major moral justification. In a world that can do that to people, there needs to be a place of safety. And that place of safety is Israel. It also happens that I love the place. I love the smells. I love the geography. It's my second home now, which is a lovely. I haven't been there because of COVID, but I mean, it's the most beautiful place, you know. So I'm extremely fortunate to have this as my other home as well.
As we wrap up today's discussion, it's been so interesting covering all these bases and your own personal journey in the midst of all this, Giles. What about the Church of England, you know, the place where, you know, you found your home and you've been, you know, and you're now ploughing this furrow as a local parish priest. But a lot of people, you know, and I think you've commented on this in some of your articles, wonder whether there will be a Church of England in the future. You know, often the statistics aren't in favour of that. And there's a lot of division within the church always on things. You've been quite critical of some of the recent strategies for growth and that sort of thing. What's the future in your view for the Church of England?
Well, I'm not going to crystal ball, guys, but I believe in the a very traditional old school idea that the Church of England is at its best when it's in its parishes, when it's local, it's on the ground. And I think that, I mean, and I suppose this goes with all my sort of fears of being deracinated and so forth. The local is the place where it is, that rootedness. And so I believe very strongly in the parish system. And my anxiety about sort of parish structures, which may be more evangelistically fleet of foot, my worry about them is that they end up you end up creating a sort of two-tier system in the Church of England, and that the resources will end up being diverted into those forms of evangelistic activity which can produce quick results. But I think the place of the church on the ground is what makes the Church of England distinctive and important in my life.
I think you put it something like this in an article. I may be misquoting, but it's less about the latest evangelistic strategy, more about just being faithful. You think that there's just a value to doing what you're called to do and be faithful, even when you don't see necessarily the results, you know, that a business might
exactly. Sometimes there is a sort of there are quick and easy ways to bring in the punters, but actually, what we're really called to do is not to be successful, but to be faithful. Now, I know there's a tension between those two sorts of things, and some people might say, well, you know, you can be both, I suppose. But sometimes, you know, we're called to live out the tradition as we understand it and as we feel called to it. And, you know, sometimes that faithfulness is a hard, difficult, and it doesn't feel terribly fruitful. There could be all sorts of biblical passages that I could, you know, bring out where people are saying these sorts of things. But sometimes the wheat that falls on the stony ground that can come up quickly is not what we should be going for.
It's been lovely to chat with you. Thank you very much for the time, Giles. Another mention of the book, Giles Fraser, it's Chosen, Lost and Found Between Christianity and Judaism, published by what is the publisher?
Alan Lane Penguin,
yeah, imprint of Penguin. So there was a link from that on today's show. If you want to check that out, go to premierchristianradio.com/theprofile. And don't forget that today's show brought to you in partnership with Premier Christianity Magazine, where you can read today's profile with Giles as well. But for now, thank you very much, Giles, for being my guest on the show.
Dear boy, very nice, very nice.